This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome, listeners, to Postcards from the Edge. I'm your host, Justin Ozer, filling in for Amy Nelson this week. With me today is Clara Cook from Trek FM's Primitive Culture podcast. Clara, thank you for coming on Postcards.
Wow, thank you for having me, Justin.
So this is the first time you've been on Postcards, so why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and share with us your Star Trek story?
So I live in London, and I have lived in London since I was about 4 years old. And I was actually born abroad. I was born in Japan and also lived in the US. And I started watching Star Trek. God, I don't know. I must have been about 4 or 5. I started with the original series. I think the first film I ever saw was The Wrath of Khan when I was about 8 years old. And I cried a lot at the end of the film. My mum had to comfort me and tell me that Spock was coming back because I was very upset Spock dying. And then I spent most of my sort of teenage years watching Next Generation. And so I grew up with the original series and Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. So those are my shows, really. That was kind of what Star Trek meant to me, and the films, and the films.
Excellent. So do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about the Primitive Culture podcast?
Yeah, so Primitive Culture is a podcast on the Trek FM network, which is all about our history and our culture and how it relates to Star Trek and how Star Trek has influenced our history and our culture and our society. So we look at things like Star Trek's relationship with NASA, different films that have influenced Star Trek, different stories that have influenced Star Trek, influenced the writers, real historical events that have been used in Star Trek and shown in Star Trek, like, say, for instance, the prison uprising in Attica, or sort of stuff like the Cold War and its impact on Star Trek and storytelling. So it's very much about relating Star Trek to the real world and the opposite.
And listeners, if you haven't already checked it out, you should check out Primitive Culture. It's a great podcast. I actually had the opportunity to guest once with Duncan, who's your co-host. And I can tell you, you guys do a lot of research. So I'm always very impressed by that and love the topics that you bring up.
Yeah, it takes a lot of reading and watching lots of different types of films and television to do the research. But it is really fun. It's a lot of work, but it's fun.
No, but I mean, it shows that you guys have done a lot of research with what comes across in the podcast. So excellent. So today we are going to discuss the fan response to season 2, episode 14 of Discovery, Such Sweet Sorrow, part 2, which is the season finale. Now, if you'd like to participate and share your response, please post your comments on the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field and it will come right up. Now, we are talking about the season finale, but I wanted to let our listeners know Amy Nelson will be back with an episode next week to get your response on season 2 as a whole for a season 2 recap. So at the time of this recording, there was an incredible 593 comments, which is an 80% increase from last week and breaks the previous season 2 record of 457 comments for episode 10. So quite amazed by the response. We'll get through what we can in this episode. I want to continue something that I did when I hosted on when we talked about Saints of Imperfection for Postcards, and that's about the episode length for Discovery. So this might make Amy happy. I'll put in a few math facts here before we get to some thoughts. So Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2 was 1 hour and 5 minutes, and that's the longest episode in Discovery and also the longest non-2-hour episode in Star Trek's history. So even though season 2 had 14 episodes while season 1 had 15 episodes, there was a longer average episode length in season 2, so there was actually more overall screen time in season 2 than season 1. So season one had an average episode length of 45 minutes, 17 seconds, with an overall season length of 11 hours and 19 minutes. Season two had an average episode length of 51 minutes, 33 seconds, with an overall season length of 12 hours and 1 minute. So episode length average increased 12% and overall season length increased 6%. So there, Amy, there's lots of math for you. Anyway, I wanted to put those numbers in there because I think it's quite interesting. There was actually more screen time in season two than season one, even though there was one fewer episode. So let's get into talking about the episode. Clara, tell us your general thoughts on this episode of Discovery.
So I thought it was a really good episode. I have to say, I've really struggled with Discovery season two. I don't think I've liked it as much as a lot of people, but I felt that this episode was a really good season finale. And two-parters are sometimes hard to write, to shoot, I think. You've got to stretch a story out across two episodes, so sometimes two-parters can seem a bit long. There's a lot of filler sometimes, but I didn't feel like that with these two episodes at all. And this final episode, I felt, was really good in terms of tension. I felt the storytelling was actually quite tight and well done. But for me, the really crowning achievement of the whole episode for me was the visual effects. And I'm not necessarily someone that loves visual effects actually in stories, but I felt that the scenes where Burnham was time traveling in the angel suit and setting the signals in the past, I thought that was really artistic. I thought it was really well done, especially the use of sound, the use of visual imagery of her like sort of traveling through these different layers of time. I just thought that was brilliant. I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I was reading an interview with director Olatunde Osunsamni, who directed both parts of the two-parter. He said the largest department they have for Discovery is visual effects. They have 500 people working on visual effects, which is extraordinary. So yeah, let me give some of my general thoughts. So I thought this was an amazing episode. I think we're coming at this a little bit differently, Clara, because I've really loved season two and a lot of Discovery, but I felt like this was kind of what it had been building toward all along. And I think they took a very bold step in basically sending Discovery to the future and changing the entire era of the show. So I loved it. I thought it was, I'd have to think about it, but I think it might be my favorite season finale in Star Trek. I thought it was really great.
Yeah, and it's exciting because it opens up a whole new bunch of mm-hmm. opportunities for this, for the series. I mean, no one knows where it's going to go now. So it really is going where no man has gone before. So
yeah, or no series.
No series.
Yeah. So let's get to the fan response. So Clara, let's get started with the first comment that we have here.
So the first comment is from Brian Malosh. He says, Amy, you may not agree with me again, but here it goes. After watching it the first time, I'm going to say that Such Sweet Sorrow, Part 2, is the best TV episode ever. Not just Discovery, not just Star Trek. This is the best TV episode that I've ever seen and may ever seen. Yeah, I'm shouting. I'm blown away by what I just saw. So Brian is keen.
Brian is very enthusiastic. So Brian, I don't know if I would say it's the best TV episode ever because there's lots of TV shows I haven't seen, but I think it's really up there as one of the best episodes in Star Trek, and love the enthusiasm for sure.
Yeah, I think it's a really great episode of Star Trek, I have to say.
So Paul Wright Jr. says, awesome episode. So much going on during the battle, I definitely have to rewatch. Did Non survive? I lost track of her during the battle with Control/Leland. Very nice how they tied up all the loose ends with Spock going back in the shuttle and with his suggestion to Starfleet to basically wipe Discovery and her crew from Starfleet history. Very sad to see Cornwell sacrifice herself for the crew. I can't wait to see how things pan out in season 3 with the crew 900 plus years in the future. So I'm curious about your opinion. Did Non survive, do you think?
Yeah, I think she did. I think she did. I hope she did.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really love the character. But I was rewatching, and I think the last time we see her, she's kind of like face down in the corridor, and then Leland and Georgiou go off toward engineering, and you don't see Non again. But I have to assume that she's still there, hopefully.
I did wonder if she was actually part of the crew that agreed to go into the future, because wasn't she originally Captain Pike's?
She was on the Enterprise, but there was actually a little part in the first part of Such Sweet Sorrow where she said that she was, yeah. But it was just like a little bit.
Oh, well, that's good.
She did say she wanted to stay with them.
So she won't be shocked when she wakes up.
No, I think she's along for the ride.
So the next quote is from Eva Lee. And she says, great episode. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. The best one of this season. It really answered a lot of questions. Amazing.
Yeah. And we're going to get into more of those questions that were answered because we definitely have some comments about how they answer those questions. Larry Selvage Jr. says, this was a big screen production on my TV. Great conclusion of seasons 1 and 2. Loved how it all came together. Still overwhelmed by everything. This shows why Star Trek had to come back to TV this way. Yeah, I think I agree with that because, I mean, I think what you got with that season arc in season 2 and, you know, having this two-parter that's like a feature-length movie is actually different, much different than if you just, you know, when you have a Star Trek movie every couple years.
Yeah, I think the way that television is broadcast now is quite different to the television that was broadcast in the past. So Star Trek now is much more, you know, it's like a story arc that's being told over like 10 or 12 episodes. They only have a limited amount of time to tell a story. So they can't really do the sort of individual story episodes that they used to do in previous series. So I guess they've got to make the most of the format that they've got. And I think they really tried to do that this season.
Yeah. And I want to comment on something that Larry also said, great conclusion of seasons 1 and 2, because as I was thinking about it, I tweeted out something yesterday, like episode 1 and 2 of season 1 were a prologue to the rest of season 1. Season 1 was really a prologue to season 2. Now seasons 1 and 2 are really a prologue to season 3. So it's like it's just kind of beginning, which I thought was amazing just to think about.
Yeah, I think they're definitely thinking about going beyond 3 seasons if they can. I feel sort of feels like they're setting it up for something bigger, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the next person is Henry Galaza, and he said, wow, they threw everything plus the kitchen sink into this finale. Budget be damned.
Yeah, I know that at one point, I think a little while ago, it was reported they spend about $8 to $8.5 million an episode on Discovery. I wonder if they spent a lot more on this one because it certainly looked like it. So.
Yeah, and I think all the damage that was done to all the sets, you know, I mean, that must have cost a lot of money if they're going to have to use some of the sets again. They've got to repaint them now and, you know.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Man, so much damage. So Maggie Shell says, I am so in love with this episode. I'm going to be rewatching tomorrow morning and I will say something more coherent. LOL. I think that was a lot of the reaction, like, wow, I need to rewatch that. There was so much that was going on. I was just kind of, I mean, we'll talk about it in some of the different comments, but I was impressed. Like, if you take a look at it, it's like there was this part and then this part. And I mean, like there were so many different parts within the hour. It was really something.
Yeah, they weaved in a lot of different storylines together, which I thought was quite clever, actually, quite clever storytelling.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about it, but I mean, I don't know. There may have been more than just like ABC plot. There might have been like a lot more than that going on. So, yeah.
So the next comment is from Bill Sweet. He said, well, we knew they'd end up in the future and I'm relieved it wasn't a full-on reset button, meaning the Discovery is a verboten topic, not erased from the timeline. I hope she comes back to this era. I'll be a little bummed out if the show moves to the far forward forever. Won't Georgiou need to get back for Section 31? But all in all, it was amazing. Some of the best battle effects for the Enterprise ever, and the cinematic hugeness of space. A battle that was really of the scale that we usually had to content ourselves to remain in our imagination, in the books and the comics, for TOS, I mean. Really beautiful character stuff, with Spock off to find his opposite. That made me tear up, as did Saru's sister. Much more satisfying season end than last year, and Mama Klingon got to kick some butt.
Thanks, Bill. Wow, there's a lot going on in your comment. That was funny at the end. I think the first thing is, I think there was some fear among some fans that they would just, you know, reset things, but they didn't. And I was glad of that. I think Discovery has shown a resistance to hitting the reset button, except for Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. And that was kind of part of what was going on in that episode. But I'm glad, you know, everything really happened. So I think that's good. As far as whether they'll come back to this era, I think that they can't. They can't go back with, you know, the data that they have. And I think they just have to stay in the future, which is a really bold thing.
Yeah, but I think also that means that there's lots more potential for new stories in the future. So that's kind of exciting. I did like what Bill was talking about when he talks about Spock looking for his opposite. And you know that Burnham's referring to Kirk. I thought that was a really good moment where she was like, people will reach for you and you have to reach back. And I thought this is setting him up for one of the greatest friendships of his life. So,
absolutely. Oh, and one other thing. So about Georgiou needing to get back for the Section 31 show. Yeah, I think when you posted that comment, I was like, yeah, she needs to come back for the Section 31 show that's been announced and that she's going to be a star in, although we're assuming it's in the 23rd century. Maybe it's Section 31 in the 32nd century.
That'll be interesting.
That would be weird. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how they deal with that because they've already basically said she'll be back. So we'll see. All right. So James Gunther says, Star Trek just passed Star Wars in epic battles. I had to keep rewinding to catch everything, and I'm sure I'm still missing important things, and I'm not sure everything makes sense. I'll have to watch it again. I love the disco theme mixed with the TOS theme at the end. Wait, is Disco going to become a prequel and a sequel? Some good thoughts in there. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but yes, it's a prequel and a sequel, which is also something we've never seen before. So that's like an interesting idea.
Yeah, I guess time is not linear, is it? It's not one straight line. So it's a big kind of circle almost in this particular series. So there can be a prequel and a sequel.
Yeah. I mean, and also, yeah, the end credits where they mixed the Discovery theme with the TOS theme was really great. I actually wasn't expecting that there would be that kind of mix of the different elements. I really love that.
So Ryan Bramble said, I've been hot and cold on this season, but I'll give them a lot of credit for answering virtually every question, continuity issue I had. Most shows can't pull that off.
Yeah, so I'm curious, what did you think about the parts at the end where there are the questions and they say, you know, Discovery blew up and Spock is saying we need to make sure we don't, you know, talk about Discovery or Burnham again. Did that work for you?
I mean, it's awfully convenient and I'm fine with it, really. I'm not one of these people that really is a slave to canon. So if Spock never mentions his sister in any other series, and everyone's like, why didn't he mention that he had an adoptive sister? That doesn't really bother me. I mean, there's lots of things that people have in their lives that they don't talk about with other people. And it's not that he might have mentioned his sister to Kirk or McCoy. He just maybe didn't mention it on camera, you know? So I'm not sure canon is really something that bothers me. So I think I understand they wrapped it up for the audience, but yeah, it's fine either way for me, really. I think I think that the questions about who set the signals was more kind of my, I wanted to know who set the signals. And then when it turned out it was Burnham, and then she realized when she had to set the signals, I thought that was kind of nice. I was like, I see that now.
Yeah, they closed that circle. Yeah, I mean, for me, I've felt for a long time like they don't necessarily need to do anything because we don't see like every minute of the lives of all the Star Trek characters. They may talk about people off screen or whatever. But I think I did see that there were some people that were like, oh, my questions about how it fits in are dealt with. So, I mean, I think it's good in that sense, people that had those lingering questions and they didn't do it as a reset. So I thought they did it pretty well overall. All right. So Paul A. Brooks says, I'm very happy for one simple reason. Discovery is free. She's free to boldly go wherever she wants now, free of Trek canon. It was the right move. And yes, that was definitely one of the best Trek battles of all time, if not the best ever. Yeah. So I saw an interview with Alex Kurtzman, and I think he was basically saying one of the reasons why they wanted to send Discovery so far into the future is that it's further in the future than we've seen in Trek before, really. I think there was a discussion in the post about this, but I think the furthest we had seen beyond this was in the Voyager episode Relativity, which I think was in the 29th century. But basically, they don't have to worry about affecting things like in the future. They can kind of do what they want. And yeah, I'd imagine that is very freeing for what they can do.
Yeah, and I think I also would agree that the battle scenes were really, really good. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that he says that this was definitely one of the best Trek battles of all time. I agree with him. I think it wasn't just the, you know, the special effects of the ships out in space, but it was also the reactions of the crew on the different bridges. I think when they get shaken and, you know, Burnham falls down and you really see the impact of hitting the deck. And I sometimes feel like in some of the other series of Star Trek, it's like there's a little turbulence and they kind of bump around in their seats a bit, you know? Whereas this, it really felt like it was like all fire, hell, everything was breaking loose all the time and people are being thrown back and forth. And also the fight between Georgiou and Leyland when the gravity goes on and off.
Yeah.
And they're like jumping from one side of the corridor to the other. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing I was noticing is, yeah, usually in a lot of Star Trek, like it shakes the ship and you see them like move one way or the other. It felt like it was like a more violent shake. Like when I was watching on the Enterprise, it was like, whoa, they're ready to just like topple over. So, yeah. It was pretty amazing. I mean, and that battle lasted for a long time. I think it was a good 40 minutes of the episode or something like that, which was really something. So
Bill Sweet is said doing a happy dance that there was no reveal involving the Borg.
Yes. I mean, I had said I don't think it has anything to do with the Borg, and it doesn't, and which makes sense. So my personal theory was that the control had gotten something from the sphere data about the Borg or about assimilation techniques from another culture and was just adapting it, and it just looks similar.
I mean, I don't know. Do we even know like how the Borg originated, or is that actually a mystery within the universe?
Well, within what you see on screen, it is a mystery, and all of that you get, I think, in Voyager is that they've been around at least 1,000 years. But you do definitively get the origin in the Star Trek Destiny novels, which are some of my favorites. That goes into the origin, but on screen it hasn't been established, and they're not required to go along with that.
Okay.
All right. Oh, and I noticed, Bill, you got 2 comments, but I wanted to put in the one about the Borg. So Suzanne Williamson says, I can't be the only one that wanted Spock to look into the scope at his station at the end. I just really wanted that visual. I think I did too, although, man, we'll talk about it more in some other comments, but it was so great to just see them on the bridge of the Enterprise at the end. Spock's in his uniform, clean shaven, and they're going to go off on their adventures. I just kind of love that as a way to kind of close the book on the season, which started with the Enterprise appearing.
Yeah, I think there was a moment where he sort of looks at his science station and as if he's kind of like, oh, this is my spot. This is my place. And I noticed that. Yeah. And then sort of he's taking his place in the story and in the franchise, you know, that's his little spot. So it was kind of acknowledging that. But yeah, I know what she means. The next comment is from Kevin Lee Hebenstreit. I hope I said that right. Overall, a really great finale. Better than the last one. I think the finale is a chance for the show to discover a whole new path for itself, one which represents one of Star Trek's best qualities, to evolve beyond its roots while holding on to the values of its past.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, evolving beyond its roots while holding on to the values of the past. And I mean, I think overall, Discovery has done that. They've, you know, acknowledged and tried to be respectful of what's come before while trying to expand that and now expanding like beyond that somewhere into the future. So,
yeah, they've sort of walked a fine line between the sort of dark themes of kind of modern television, you know, with the sort of Section 31 stuff, but also at the same time trying to hold up the Federation values as well. I thought that was quite apparent in this season, actually.
And I mean, for me, I think that makes it closest to Deep Space Nine, which I always felt was doing the same kind of thing. Like it was going into a darker place. You're really outside of the Federation, but they were having to do things to kind of try to, you know, deal with the difficulties of upholding Federation values. So I think it's kind of a similar thing. So Shoaib Mirza says, whoa, what in the 7 red signals has happened? Incredible cinematic experience. This episode will take many viewings to grasp the multiple interweaved plots and make sense of the cliffhanger. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've seen this episode twice. Now I need to see, you know, season 2 from start to finish. And then I think I need to see season 1 and 2 start to finish to really kind of like absorb the whole journey. Because, I mean, the thing about this show is that there are things that they are doing that go all the way back to the very first episode. So it'd be interesting to see it like as a whole instead of just episode by episode.
Yeah, I think I have to probably rewatch season 2, partly because sort of in the middle I dipped a little bit. I might have, I don't know, snoozed a bit during certain episodes. Uh-oh. So, and I think now that I know what it's all building towards, I think I could be like, oh, that's why that's there and that's why that makes sense, which I think before I was like, where are they going with this?
Yeah, and I think I found that with season 1. Once it was over and I rewatched it, I was like, oh, that's the thing that connects over here. And it's just a different experience when you know what's going to happen. You can kind of take it in more.
And so the next comment is from Karen Chipless. I can't even yet. All I can say right now is I'm glad Jet is on board. Plus, she was awesome. Everyone was awesome. And while I was in such a daze, I need to watch again. The Spock Burnham scenes broke my heart.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, what do you think of Jet Reno? She's been on, I guess, 4 episodes. What do you think of her character?
So, I really like Jet Reno, and I would prefer to see more of her, actually. I feel like I haven't seen enough of her. So, I assume, obviously, in the new season, hopefully, she will be there and we'll see more of her. But I really like her. I think that I like how straight talking she is, how she's sarcastic. She reminds me a bit of McCoy. She's like a McCoy engineer. Do you know what I mean? So, and I like that about her. I think she's definitely a character that could go really far in the story.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I love the character. And I think we've got to see at least a little bit more, but I can't tell if it'll just be like sporadic appearances or if I'll make her a bit more of a regular. And Karen, you also mentioned the Spock Burnham scenes. Ugh, those ones got to me as well. We'll talk more about the goodbyes later, but I mean, them having to say goodbye and talking about their journey and all of that. I definitely had some tears in my eyes during that time.
And I like that Spock said something to her in Vulcan.
Yes.
I kind of wish the Vulcans would talk Vulcan more, or speak Vulcan more.
Yeah.
In Star Trek. I like to hear the different languages. And I understand the Universal Translator is an amazing, amazing piece of technology that allows everyone to understand each other. But I'm like, oh, can we have a little bit more Vulcan language? Because we get quite a lot of Klingon language.
That's true. I would like to hear more Vulcan, although because Vulcan's been part of the Federation for a couple hundred years, I figure that anyone who is in Starfleet or really venturing a lot outside of the planet may also speak English for simplicity. I don't know.
Yeah.
Could be wrong about that.
I think
that.
The Vulcans are probably very, very good at learning other languages as well.
That's true. Quite true. So, Janessa Chiarda says, I'm going to need a second or fourth rewatch to figure out how I feel about it, but I'm glad last week's episode paid off in this week's and the writers didn't take the easy way out. Kudos. And I really love the Neil deGrasse Tyson quote at the end. I unequivocally squeed at that. So the quote is, the universe is under no obligation to make sense to me. I think that's something that Spock said. And I noticed like, oh, that's a really cool thing. I didn't notice it was Neil deGrasse Tyson. So thank you, Janessa, for pointing that out. It was nice. I don't know. I just like that that quote.
Yeah, and I like it that it's somebody who, you know, is revered in science history. So people are quoting these scientists that were alive a long time ago, but actually they're scientists that are alive now. So it's kind of harking back to our current history. So it's, you know, he's like, oh yeah, this scientist I read from a few hundred years ago or whatever it is. Actually, it's probably centuries, isn't it? But, you know, it's one of our scientists, and that's quite cool. So Tim Han said, sensational finale to what has been a terrific, much improved season for Discovery from season one. Really need to absorb everything first before making any detailed comments, but what a superb conclusion and send off it was. Liked Spock's shaven look at the very end, which I predicted would happen long ago, but didn't agree with the sideburns. A little too long, I'm afraid. Now bring on that damn Captain Pike and Spock series.
So, yeah, thanks, Tim. I actually hadn't thought about the sideburns, and then your comment made me look back, and I was like, yeah, it is a little bit longer, but, you know, maybe he's still transitioning from the full beard, and it'll be a little shorter in a few years, so it works in canon. But yeah, you mentioned the Pike and Spock series, which, yeah, there's been that fan petition out there to give us a series, and I think it got something like 20,000 signatures so far, and Anson Mount was noticing it, and Alex Kurtzman was saying, you know, you've been heard, anything's possible, so maybe it'll happen. I would certainly love to see that. Would you like to see a kind of Pike-Spock Enterprise series?
I think I would prefer to see more about Pike, to be honest. I'm not saying that I don't think that the actor who plays Spock isn't a good actor. I think he did a brilliant job. But I sort of feel like I feel like Spock's story really properly starts when he meets Kirk. And I feel like that's kind of the sort of era of Spock that I'm more interested in. But Pike has been one of my favorite things about Discovery. And I would love to see more of number one, Una, her name is Una, which I love actually. I love the fact that her name's Una. I'd love to see more about more of Captain Pike. And I think Anson Mount has done a great job of portraying that character. It is sad though, because we know what's going to happen to Pike and it's not happy. So that there is a melancholic aspect of his story, really.
That's true. Although there is the other part of it at the end of the menagerie that's maybe a little happier.
Yeah. But
still, he has to go through a lot for sure. So Andrea Boot says, best finale ever. The battle scenes were simply fantastic and the special effects looked stunning. The death of Admiral Cornwell was, and then there's five emojis of a flood of tears. And she says, words fail me at this moment, so emojis will have to suffice. So glad Culber and Stamets are finally back together. The tension between those two is getting so hard you could cut it with a knife. Let's see what the 31st century has in store. The countdown to season 3 begins. Yeah, Admiral Cornwell sacrificed herself. I've loved that character, so I was quite sad about that, but she faced it bravely at the end.
It was a good death, though. It was a good death. If you're going to die in a Star Trek universe, you want to die saving people's lives.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, and we'll talk more about it, because people had some questions about how that happened. So there were some more comments. But I just wanted to note, yeah, that made me very sad. And I was surprised. I guess I expected there might be somebody significant, but I didn't know it was going to be Cornwell.
So Chris Hill said, holy ship, this is how you end a season. Discovery has hit it out of the park. The emotional highs and lows were on point. They have set up a Pike series if they so choose. Please? I have a feeling Ash was going to get the Klingons involved. I wasn't expecting the Kelpians and the Bowel to show up. So good on the writing team there. That was one epic space battle. I'm looking forward to what is to come with season 3.
Yeah, and that was ship, S-H-I-P.
Holy ship.
yeah. Just like when number one was talking about in the last episode, when the ship hits the fan. But I guess a couple of things. It was great that the Klingons got involved. I'll probably say more about that a little bit later. Yeah, the Kelpians in the Bowel, I totally wasn't expecting that, but I think I cheered when that happened. But it's the Kelpians in the Bowel ship. I don't think the Bowel were actually there, as far as I know.
Yeah, I thought the Kelpians had basically used the Bowel technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was pretty great.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming. That was a twist I didn't see coming.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. So Kevin Parla Greco says, I'm glad the season is over and now 950 years in the future. Discovery can make its own stories away from the Enterprise. Maybe without having to develop TOS materials, we will get more character development. And in the meantime, let's gear up for Star Trek Pike. The most thrilling part, in my opinion, was seeing the 1701 and crew on screen. So, more votes for a Pike series. And acknowledging also that they can do stories now that are, you know, kind of free of having to connect to TOS. So,
and also exploring what a Star Trek universe would look like in 950 years in the future. You know, what the Federation has become and that kind of thing. Hopefully, not something awful and dystopian. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, we'll see. And there's actually more a little bit later where we'll, I think, talk about what this means.
So Brandon Chiamatala said, okay, that was a lot of fun. Orson Sanmi's direction was great this week, and I really loved the split screen sequence at the start of the episode. If you want to see a movie that utilizes this in an amazing way, you should check out Brian De Palma's Sisters. The battle sequences were top-notch, and this is the kind of thing I've been dreaming of in Star Trek and what our special effects can do. I really enjoyed having all the elements of the Red Angels jumps collide in the climax to the episode. While a lot of the dialogue was cringeworthy, there were a few gems, including Follow the Queen. It will be a lot of fun going back to watch the whole season now that we know the whole story. They purposely kept the interrogator's face hidden at the end. I was hoping for a reveal of someone we had already seen. So does this mean that season 3 will be an Enterprise show? Because that's the distinct impression I'm getting from the end of this. I'm kind of okay with that, but I don't want to never see the Discovery crew again.
Yeah, I think it was interesting because, you know, people saw that, and in isolation, that could have been a finale, like this is the end of Discovery, but it was renewed for season 3 some weeks ago, and they've been talking about what they'll do for season 3. So yeah, it was an interesting choice to just end it on the bridge of the Enterprise, but season 3 will still be all about the Discovery.
He talks about the split screen sequences. I actually thought that was really good because it's very rare in sort of like a battle that you get to see the different members of the bridge crew talking to other members of bridge crews. It's normally like the captain talking to another captain. So it was nice to see like the helmsman and the different crews talking to each other and kind of working together. And you could only really do that with a split screen, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that was great because a lot of times, like if it's two Starfleet ships, you might just see one through the view screen instead of seeing the brute. It depends. But yeah, that was really great and just kind of going back and forth. So, Brandon, glad you mostly enjoyed the episode. I know you have issues with the dialogue, but but I think you enjoyed it quite a bit, which is good. So, Mark Keller says, I think Disco's jump to the future is going to be awesome. It's exciting that we are going to see new alien civilizations, and it will be interesting to see what the Federation and the Klingon Empire are like 900 years from now. Will there even be a Federation? Will members of the crew meet future ancestors? What is future technology going to be like? If you think about it, the possibilities are endless. Yeah, I agree. I mean, they could kind of go wherever they want to with it. So we'll see what happens. I hope there's still a Federation, but I think they might end up in the Beta Quadrant and they have a spore drive so they can go elsewhere. But I don't know. I don't know what it'll be.
And also, will anyone in the future be waiting for them? Because if they're going to be part of history in the future, I mean, and assuming that I suppose time travel is still something that's available, like with the time crystals and stuff. I have a lot of problems with time crystals, but we won't talk about that now. but like, so will there be anybody in the future who'll be like, Discovery's going to show up any day now, you know?
I mean, that's a really great point, because there are people that know how many years they're going in the future. Is that information preserved and passed down so that there's going to be someone that might be waiting for them? Ooh, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, just, we'll see. You know, just a question. So Tim Robertson has said, just finished watching it a second time. There was so much going on in the episode. It's difficult to digest it all. First off, I like everything that ended up happening. Discovery is out of that time period before the original series. It never really belonged there. The Enterprise and Pike storyline was amazing. If CBS doesn't jump on this as a series, they are foolish. I want that more than any Section 31 or Discovery or Picard series. Just an old TOS guy here. So the Captain of Discovery is Saru. Doesn't Georgiou outrank him? So much for her being on the Section 31 show. Looks like Tyler is the star of that show. Hopefully the whole crew of Discovery has sent a little farewell messages to their families before they all get sent into the future. The space battle was visually stunning. So glad it lasted well too. Though it wasn't just pew 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 and over. Finally, I hate to see Cornwall go. I love Jane Brooke as that character.
Well, Tim, there's a lot going on in your comment. I think a couple of things, we talked about it before, but I think Georgiou is going to be the main character in the Section 31 show, so they need to send her back. I mean, it's interesting that Tyler is the head of Section 31. Like, okay, he's moved up pretty quickly. as far as the captain, I don't think that was really resolved. And like, you know, what is the Federation or Starfleet? Is there a command structure? Can they just make up their own rules about who's the captain of the ship at that point? I mean, so many unanswered questions. We're going to have to speculate so much in the next year, aren't we? So I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Hakur Gudmundsson says, whoa, what a visually and Star Trek-like beautiful ending of the episode. Makes me want a Piker Prize show even more. I like that word, Piker Prize. Also, what a bold move to move them into the future and let the story continue there. I wish they'd stay in the pre-TOS era or go to the post-Nemesis era, but with what we've gotten so far, I think I can trust the writers to make another great season. And the crew we now have on board Discovery is amazing. Probably the very first one with more or exactly the same amount of female leads than male leads. I remember when I started as a teenager watching Star Trek, the only thing I didn't like about it was the extremely low proportion of women in the main cast compared to men. I come from Iceland where equity is quite high, and back then we didn't have the internet, so it wasn't something I learned as an SJW to dislike. It just stuck out like a sore thumb. No more Sarek, Amanda, Laurel, Tyler, and Kenneth Mitchell's Klingons. Well, he can come back again and again, though. I wonder if Linus is still with us, or if he's the same Linus the Saurian in the motion picture on the Enterprise. Well, lots of great comments there. So, yeah, I think it is something that Discovery's consciously been doing that I've liked, that there's been, it's been a little more equal with the female members of the main cast and the supporting cast. So, I think that's been good, right?
Yeah, and I think that when he mentions, like, sort of more women in the series, I think one of the things that really stuck in my mind from this particular episode was the moment where they're going to go deal with the unexploded torpedo warhead, and the two people that go into the turbolift to go and get the job done are like number one and Admiral Cornwall, and they're both just like, all right, we're gonna do this, and they get in the turbolift and they go, and I was like, yay, had a little cheer there. I was like, the women are gonna get this done. sadly, obviously it didn't end happily, but but it's like, you know, it's just a given, you know, that they're crew members and they're going to sort it out. Really, their gender doesn't come into it. And I think that's kind of what Star Trek should be about, really.
Yeah. I mean, and interestingly, one thing that I somehow didn't even think about is, like, we're not going to see Sarek or Amanda or Laurel on Discovery. that's kind of sad because I really like those characters. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's such an interesting thing because like I was watching, they do this Facebook Live event each week and they interview people and they're interviewing Sonequa Martin-Green. And like, basically they're also saying goodbye to people that they won't be working with on Discovery going forward. So, you know, like James Frain or Mia Kirshner or whoever, it's like, this is it for us working with them. Like, oh. So it's a goodbye from like the cast point of view, as well as from, you know, us saying, you know, goodbye to that era or whatever, and the characters in the show. So I think it's interesting. It's just like a goodbye on so many levels.
Yeah, no more shots of Vulcan. I was enjoying seeing the shots of Vulcan. And also the shots of places like Boreth. I guess actually they could go to those places in the future.
Well, I think both of them will still exist at that point.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
Oh, I mean, assuming nothing has happened, but I don't think they would do that, at least for Vulcan.
So Chris, who is at William Manbong on Twitter, said, "You'll have to mind meld with me to find the right words, because to quote Anson Mount's Pike from part one, there aren't words. Lol. I mean, it's like literally all emotion for me. It's that powerful."
Yeah, I have to say, like, I think I've commented before that different episodes of Discovery make me cry. And when I say that, I mean there are, like, tears in my eyes. I don't tend to have, like, you know, tears rolling down my face or anything. But there were points in this episode, including one we'll talk about later, where I was just sobbing. I was just, like, it was so emotional for me. And I think for a lot of people. So, okay. So, Gloria, who's at Truly Gloria on Twitter, says, "Loved it. There was excitement, action, and a lot of heart. It's been a great journey this season, and the show has renewed my love for the franchise." Well, so glad to hear that, you know, when it's renewed someone's love for the franchise and, you know, getting back into Star Trek. Yeah.
I also wonder how many people who've never seen Star Trek before, you know, like younger generations, I wonder if this is their first introduction, you know, like how a lot of people say, you know, Next Generation was my first introduction, or Deep Space Nine. I wonder how many people are being like, oh, my first introduction to the franchise was Discovery, you know, that's my crew.
I've thought about that because, you know, you hear on podcasts when people tell their story, like, oh, I saw the original series, I saw the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, whatever. But there are going to be people doing podcasts in the decades to come who were introduced based on Discovery. And this will be like the time when they've found Star Trek, which is, I mean, that's awesome. I mean, that's why it's so great to have new content.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So at Trekkie Rob on Twitter said, "It was awesome." And he spelled it out really awesome.
Yeah.
"Was gutted that we had to say goodbye to Admiral Cornwall. She was a great character. The battle scenes were very impressive. So excited for the future." See what I did there? Of Star Trek Discovery.
Excellent. Yeah. So at Daniel Huckfield on Twitter says, "I have been quite critical of how the writers have handled the story over these two seasons, but this finale hit the nail on the head. It had a great pace and wrapped everything up so well, intrigued by what ship we will see next season." Well, yeah, I think that's interesting feedback for someone who's been quite critical for a while, but loved the finale, and now it's going to be something different. So maybe it opens up, you know, things that they'll continue to appreciate. And when you say intrigued by what ship we'll see next season, I mean, I think they're still on the Discovery. I mean, maybe that meant like the different ships we'll see in the future. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, because they could really, I mean, they could be really adventurous with that, couldn't they? Because, you know, who's to say like what technological advancements have happened in 900 years?
Actually, it's kind of interesting to think about, because I've been going through some of the Strange New World stories, which were written by fans, and they did that for about 10 years in the 90s and 2000s, and like they had a special thing in 2016. But for some of the later ones, they have these things called speculations, where fans were writing stories, and some of them go thousands, tens of thousands, or even like a million years into the future, and you read it, and you're like, wow, they managed to extrapolate all this technology. So it's possible, because I can certainly hear people saying like, it's going to just be like, you know, pure magic in 1,000 years. I mean, I don't know. We'll see what it's like. But that is exciting, because they get to develop all kinds of new, you know, ships and technologies and possibly new civilizations that, you know, hadn't even been spacefaring from eras that we've seen, right?
And also, if you think about when the original series was made, and to a certain extent, like Next Generation, even sometimes Deep Space Nine, were, you know, the production had to be, when they didn't have the money that they have now to do series and to do Star Trek shows. So a lot of the production was, you know, using prosthetics on humans' faces, people's faces. And now, I mean, the aliens could be quite different. They could actually be very non-humanoid, which is interesting because there's that criticism that in Star Trek, almost all the aliens are humanoid. But that's because obviously they had sort of a limited amount of resources and they didn't have the special effects they have, whereas now they do.
And the chase kind of explained it, but still, yeah. I mean, there should be more non-humanoids out there.
But it could do that. They could do that in the future. I mean, you know, in this new series, because they have the special effects and the money now. So they could actually go and do something really strange and alien.
Really out there. Yeah.
I'm not sure how that would go down with all the fans, but...
somebody will complain about
it. I mean, fans seem very split on everything nowadays, don't they? So.
Yeah, but that's been going on for a long time, I think, but... So, but yeah, it'll be interesting because there'll be a whole new set of things we can react to.
So Joshua DeVries said, I spent the whole episode barely breathing, except when Hugh told Stamets he wasn't leaving him. And then I got misty-eyed. Wow, what a gripping finale. Bring on season 3.
Yeah, Culber and Stamets and Culber saying that he's family. Yeah, I was definitely very touched by that. And I mean, I knew they weren't going to break them apart, but just to kind of see that and that they're going together into the future... was just amazing to see, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens there. Assuming Stamets is fine, I'm going to assume he's fine.
Okay, I think he'll be patched up. You know, people have had worse injuries, haven't they, on Star Trek?
Yeah, they have for sure. So Dennis Tremethic says, wow, that battle was excellent and right out of the Ronald Moore Battlestar Galactica. Amazing. Old timers got their phaser beams and photon torpedo sounds. We have a reason for the continuity gap. We will see a new future of the Prime Universe, eagerly anticipating what it will be. Will actions in the Picard show be revisited? How does Giorgio get back to work in Section 31? So, yeah, that's an interesting thing. So, we thought that the Picard show would be advancing us further than we had before, but now we have Discovery kind of leapfrogging it. So, it will be interesting if there are things that happen in the Picard show and they're like echoes that reverberate, you know, 800 years later or something. It's weird to think about.
Yeah, so I guess what we're going to get is we're going to get post-Nemesis in one show and then years forward in the future in Discovery.
Post-everything.
So, we're going to get two sequel shows, really, aren't we?
Yeah,
which is basically kind of exciting, I think. Yeah, I'm curious to find out how they're going to, because I guess anything they do in the Picard show might have to be reflected in Discovery, but not necessarily, because
800 some odd years, like you don't have to reflect things that have happened
true.
Because there's so much that could happen. But yeah, it's an interesting thought. Yeah, and Dennis, you also mentioned the phaser beams and the photon torpedo sounds. I loved all the TOS sounds that they had going on. That was really cool.
And he also mentioned Ronald D. Moore and Battlestar Galactica, and I agree with him. I do think that the battle scenes were very much like the battle scenes of Battlestar Galactica. And I would say also like the battle scenes in sort of Firefly and Serenity, you know, the other science fiction series.
I haven't seen more than a few episodes of any of those.
Well, it's something to do with the way they're filmed. It's almost a little bit like the ships are moving. I don't know. It's hard to explain that the way the camera sort of is almost looking at something from far away and then kind of coming close in. The ships are moving very fluid-like. But it sort of says to me is that there's this big expanse of space and the ships are sort of fighting each other in this huge expanse of space. Just feels very empty, but then there's all this battle going on in this big empty sort of space-like view, if that makes sense. I thought it was quite different than other Star Trek battles.
I think so. I mean, you could really see the hugeness of space. I mean, in a way that even going back to the first episode of season one, when Burnham is going to, you know, see the Klingon object, when she's like really tiny, its space feels like really big. So I think they've done a good job when they've, you know, had that kind of opportunity. All right, so now we're going to go on to a section called Bits and Pieces. So, Clara, do you want to read the first one?
So, Serena Rodriguez said, I didn't catch if they actually named number one. I thought I heard Pike call her Una, but I may have misheard.
Yeah, I think we talked about this before, but yes, Pike did call her Una. That was confirmed by the co-showrunner of season 3 and writer Michelle Paradise. I think there was some confusion because... For us, watching CBS All Access, the transcript or the closed captioning was wrong. So I think there's a part where Pike says, like, I'm giving you the con, Una, right? Which is what he says. But it in the CBS captions, it was, I'm giving you the con and Admiral. So they just totally missed out on it. And I think I've seen on the Netflix one, it said Nuna instead of Una. So...
The question is Una called after Dr. Una McCormack, who's actually written some of the Discovery novels?
Yeah, the answer is yes. So Yay! Una and she's a great author, so it's a wonderful tribute. But yeah, like as I understand, well, so the first time that you saw number one as Una was in the 2016 Legacies novels, and they named her Una there, and I think I had read it was in honor of Una McCormack, who's a great Star Trek author. So
that's a great thing.
As someone who reads lots of novels, I love that. They're like, oh, they put it on screen. It's so awesome. But yes, everyone, that was. And if you want to go back and see, start it slightly before 41 minutes in, and a couple lines after that is when he calls her Una. That's pretty cool. So Patrick Carlin says, spotted another end credits Easter egg. Looks like one of the Klingons on Laurel's ship was named Kavort. Presumably who the Kavort class birds of prey we later see on TNG and DS9 are named for. And then Christopher D. Littlefield replied to Patrick Carlin saying, played by Glenn Hetrick, the show's creature and makeup effects designer. That's pretty awesome. I've loved, like, Glenn Hetrick and Neville Page are working together on the, you know, the creature design and makeup effects stuff, but for Glenn Hetrick to play a Klingon is pretty cool. And he had a line in there too.
Yeah, I think that's everybody's dream, isn't it? To play play some sort of alien on Star Trek or a starship officer, just even in the background. I'll just be sitting there in the bridge, you know, I'll give a little wave when the camera passes by.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't need to have any lines.
I would love that someday. Well, we'll see if it can happen.
So Brandon Shia Matula said, I absolutely loved the callback to the wormhole sequence from the motion picture. So cool and so special to see that now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was toward the end where they were, you know, going into the wormhole and you see, I don't even know how to describe it. It's kind of like this blurring, like separation, which is similar to what you see in the motion picture. I thought it was, yeah, it was beautiful to see that. It was a nice callback, but also you could see on everyone's faces, they were kind of like in awe of what was happening at the same time that they're like leaving everything behind. Okay, that was the point at which I was sobbing because I was just like, they're leaving everything behind, but they're like bravely going forward and they're just still in awe of the experience. It's just like wrapped up everything of Star Trek kind of in that moment. So
I sort of felt like that was also... When they're in the search for Spock, when they go back in time, doesn't that happen then as well? Aren't their faces...
Oh, you mean Voyage Home?
The Voyage Home, sorry, yes.
Yeah, where they slingshot around. Yeah, and they're like the little faces that come up, and it's a little bit
like that.
It's
like sort of going forward or back in time, you know, your sort of sense of being is sort of stretched out across the years or something. It's really cool.
Yeah. So Bill Sweet says, I hope the season 3 news doesn't mean this is the last we see of Laurel. Since they're going to be in the future and I think can't come back, it may be the last we see of Laurel. But, you know, maybe if the Section 31 show, we can see Laurel in some way. That would be cool. I mean, it feels like they are definitely going to set the Section 31 show in the 23rd century. They've got to have cameos with some of the people that we know.
I sort of feel like Laurel needs to stay in her time period so that she can help run the Klingon Empire. The Klingons need her. They need her to be a good leader, so she has to stay with them. Janessa Chiada said, we only get a brief glimpse of the Klingon bridge. It's been updated for Disco, but still very identifiably Klingon. I liked it a lot and hope we see more of it in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Very much seemed like a Klingon bridge, for sure.
Yeah.
So Janessa also puts in quotes here, look for the one least like you. And then she puts, you know, this cute little cartoon with Spock and Kirk, which says Spock and Kirk's relationship in a nutshell. Spock, don't do the thing. Kirk, who's waving his hands up, I'm going to do the thing. So
that's very true.
I've seen that circulating for a while. It's pretty funny and very true. And yeah, it was such a nice little tribute to Kirk. I don't know if you noticed, but like at the end when Spock is called to the bridge, that sure sounded like, you know, Kirk and William Shatner's voice calling him to the bridge. Was that just me?
I didn't notice that, maybe.
On the rewatch, take a listen, because it very much sounds like that. And if that's true, like, so Kirk is on this ship at this time calling him to the bridge. Interesting. So.
Or it's, you know, it's kind of sort of a nod to the future.
It's just a little Easter egg. But it's a bit, but, you know, rewatch it and listen to it. It totally sounded like Shatner's Kirk to me.
So Mark Rodriguez says, I thought that Culber's medical instruments were a nice homage to Dr. McCoy's.
Hmm. I'll have to take a look closer because I think I was just concentrating on like this moment between them. But yeah, I'll have to take a look and see if that's like McCoy's instruments. I'm sure it is. Mark would know.
I have to say, aside from just the medical instruments, I do really love the medical staff's white uniforms. I think white is probably a bad color when you're going to be dealing with
a
lot of injured people.
Yeah.
But I think they're really stylish. They're the snazziest looking. I don't know, actually, the bright colors on the Enterprise are pretty cool too. But I think that they look really good in those uniforms.
Absolutely. All right. So we don't just talk about the positive feedback. We're going to go into questions and concerns, which includes both, you know, questions and things that may not have worked. So, Clara, do you want to do the first one?
So Jason Chapman said, "So this episode wasn't so yum-yum to me, but very interesting. More good than bad. I did cry a bit when Admiral Brighteyes sacrificed herself for the crew. Rest in peace, Admiral Brighteyes. After sleeping all night, my first thought this morning was, why didn't they get those little robots to pull the door shut? Poor Admiral Brighteyes."
Yeah, Jason was I think we're all very sad about it. You know, I've thought about this a little bit. In the heat of the battle, I think all of the robots and all the resources were very busy and the transporters were offline. However, maybe after this, they need to consider having levers on both sides of the door, just in case.
Yeah, so the door is a plot device, isn't it? I mean, the idea that someone has to die because there's no way of shutting the door except from the inside. I think that's not actually Star Trek. I think that's a very predictable plot device. It's probably used across many TV genres. So when she was like, there's only a lever on, or there's only a handle on the inside, I was like, oh, okay, she's gonna die.
For me, I was like, man, the Enterprise has a real design flaw not having it on the outside. But
I mean, my husband and I, when we were watching it, and when she clasps, you know, number one's hand, and they clasp each other's arms, and they kind of look into each other's eyes, my husband was like, she's gonna die. I was like, yeah, I know, she's gonna die.
Yeah.
Like, it's sad. I think it's a good death. I mean, you know, if you're gonna go out in the Star Trek universe, you wanna go out saving people. But I agree with you, the door was stupid. I mean, put a lever on both sides of the door. I mean, come on.
it had its issues for that. So, Bill Sweet says, one question. If Control was destroyed, why did they need to jump forward? Brian Diggs replies to Bill Sweet, Leland/Control was locally neutralized. Control was not necessarily completely neutralized. Jumping to Terralysium ensures the Control cannot become fully conscious. I thought about this as it was happening, but Leland is not all of Control. I think it's elsewhere. And toward the end, they kind of acknowledge that, like, I think when Tyler's asking, like, has Control been eradicated? Like, yeah, we've found it and eradicated it. But they still needed to send it forward. And I think when Leland dies, they were already, like, almost at the wormhole and, like, Burnham was already through. So I don't think they could reverse it anyway. And they just need the sphere data to go into the future because I think Control is still around in some form and could grab hold of it. So I don't know. It worked for me. But it was a question in my head.
Also, isn't there the possibility the sphere data could be a threat in any capacity when it comes to any artificial intelligence? So, like, not necessarily Control. What if the Borg got it, yeah, or some other artificial intelligence? I mean, I know the Borg's not, they're kind of organic as well, aren't they, rather than just computerized. But, like, I guess the point is, because they're going into the future and they're kind of completing that action, that's what kind of kills Control, was what I thought. But
yeah, I mean, and the way I took it also was, this is like a critical period for Control to get that and then eventually, you know, wipe out all sentient life within 900 years or something like that. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, but I think they still had to do it.
So Dan McWilliams says, I thought having them go off into the future for reals was very daring, and it makes me wonder what on earth they're going to do for season 3. That said, the part where Spock proposes that everyone stay mum about Discovery, obviously as a way to satisfy canonistas, is dumb. I like the way he's used this. Canonistas, that's a funny term. Canonistas are never satisfied. Go check out the X-asterisk site if you don't believe me. Another thing about Spock's proposal, I don't see how they could get this entire world they built to stop talking about Michael Burnham Discovery, both having affected not only the Federation, including civilians and prison colony people, but the Klingons as well. It's quite silly, really. I understand what the writers are trying to do, because you never hear Spock talking about her, blah blah, but I don't have to like it. Anyway, I love this season. I love that it got my wife interested in watching all the way through. They did a tremendous and wonderful job all the way through.
Okay. That part didn't work for everybody, but glad despite that that you enjoyed the season overall and that got your wife interested in it. You mentioned the prison colony people. I think Lorca made sure that they were dead. So I don't think they're
around. Who are the prison colony people?
So like in context is for Kings season one, episode three, you know, Burnham's on the prison shuttle and then it's taken over by Discovery after the shuttle pilot dies and there's this cloud of stuff. And then the prison colony people are, you know, sent away afterwards. I always just assume that Lorca did something to get rid of them, but I don't know.
I just assumed that, you know, the planet in the cage, you know, it's like off limits and they can't go there except, isn't there some sort of Federation directive that means if people go there, the penalty of death or whatever? I mean, but everyone kind of knows about it, right? So I just assume it's a little bit like that. I assume that it's somewhere buried deep in the files of the Federation headquarters. There's this file on Discovery and people kind of know of Discovery, but they don't really talk about it because there's no public memorial or anything, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah. And if people found out about it, they would just be like, it got destroyed. It's gone.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, I can understand that might not work for some people. Okay, so Reese Morgan says, well, the battle looked cool, I guess. Yay, beam phasers. Some very impressive effect shots, especially Michael leaving the shuttle bay. My enjoyment of this was spoiled by what I think has become the trope of Discovery, constant corny dialogue and forced unearned emotional scenes. I'm sure Discovery can afford two cameras so we can cut to different angles rather than spin the camera all the time. It's very jarring. I don't know how the Enterprise knew Leland beamed aboard Discovery even when Discovery didn't. How does it seem Cornwell knows what's going to happen to Pike? Have I missed something? Where does Spock's mind meld with the Red Angel fit in? Spock is an emotionally repressed Vulcan? At one point, I expected him to start singing Barry Manilow to Michael. I'm sure the Seven Red Bursts doesn't make sense, but we'll need to rewatch. I'm hoping Season 3 will be renamed Star Trek Pike. We can only hope. So yeah, Reese, a lot of questions in there. I mean, as you can probably tell from before, the emotional stuff worked for me, but I think it's not working for everybody. Also, the camera stuff works for me, but I know it doesn't work for everybody, including Amy Nelson. So that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think the actual camera work doesn't really bother me. I think I kind of agree with him a little bit about the unearned emotional scenes. I think the big part of Discovery that I struggle with the most is perhaps not as much character development as I would like. I feel like there's a lot of plot and a lot of science fiction technobabble and not as much character development as I would like. There's a few scenes here or there that I think have been really good, like the scene where they're playing that word game in the mess hall. But really, I feel nothing when it comes to Culber and Stamets. I sound cold-hearted, but I feel like they...
It's okay. You should talk to Joe Keegan.
I feel like I'm not saying that there isn't a potential for emotion to be there. I think there really is. I think the problem is that they haven't invested enough actual dialogue or scenes in that relationship. And so I didn't feel emotionally triggered, like emotionally invested in it or triggered by it. I was like, oh yeah, they're back together. Okay. Whereas I think I felt more emotional about them in season one, because we saw them kind of having a kind of normal life. I mean, there's been no normal life for any of the characters in this season. So no, like, you know, brushing teeth or eating meals and talking to each other. A lot of it's very plot driven, but that's because they have such short amount of time in which to tell the story, because they don't have 23 episodes, you know, like Next Generation or DS9.
I think that's very interesting, because I think the characters have gotten far more character development than you typically see in two seasons of a Star Trek series. Like, if, and I think about like everything that Burnham's gone through and what it's told us about her and Stamets and Culber and a lot of the other characters. For me, I think there's been a ton of character development, but it's happened in those moments when they're dealing with the really difficult things. I mean, I think we actually know far more about the main characters than we did in the first two seasons of Next Generation for those characters, but that's just my opinion.
I mean, part of it is that these other Star Trek series had a lot longer to tell stories. They had many more hours and many more episodes. And in the sort of Netflix era of television, you have, you know, 12 hours, basically. You have 12 episodes or 9 episodes. I mean, if you think about Game of Thrones, they've had seasons, lots of seasons now, but, you know, sometimes they only have 7 to 10 episodes. So you don't have as much time to explain who a character is unless you're willing to devote a whole hour. That's why I like that episode about Saru, you know, the one where he went back to his home planet, because I really felt like they devoted a whole hour to him. But I think maybe with the new season, I mean, as the series goes on, we'll get to know them better anyway, because we'll see more of them. But I hope they devote more time to the relationship between Stamets and Culber.
Okay.
So Sanjeev Gopal said, I like Spock better with the beard. Me too, man. Me too.
Oh, that's, I mean, it's so interesting because there was such a like big thing about Spock having a beard. And now I'm seeing people like, he's better with the beard. I love him with the beard. It was a little jarring in trying to get used to him being clean shaven, but I like that as well. But
I mean, he's got to be clean shaven, right? Because in the original series, he's clean shaven, except when he's a mirror universe Spock. But I have to say, this actor looks very good with his facial hair. I think he's,
yeah,
it's fine.
So in answer to Burnham from a previous episode, the beard was working. Yeah. All right, so Brandon Chamatala says, I don't understand how if the torpedo went off in the ship, number one tells us it would destroy four decks, but then they tell us it would destroy the whole ship, except when Cornwell closes the door. Yeah, like, but I was rewatching it, and I mean, I think definitely if they close the door, there's a whole lot less damage, but there was still quite a lot of damage. Yeah, I did see the four decks, and I'm not quite sure about that, because it seems like when you see a shot later, there's like this big piece out of the front of it, but... Yeah, I think if they don't close the blast door, it just like sets off this chain reaction that might destroy the ship.
It's interesting that there happens to be like random blast doors in corridors. I mean, imagine it'd be a great scene if someone accidentally triggered the blast door and then got stuck behind the blast door. Just randomly. Like say you were, I don't know, walking from your quarters to the mess hall and you accidentally triggered the blast door and then you had to wait for the engineers to come and, I don't know, burn it, like,
I figured it was a special section, but yeah.
I mean, really, the torpedo exists to kill Admiral Cornwell. It's a plot device yet again, like the door. It exists so that she can die bravely. There's no other reason why it's there. It's there so that she can die, and so that she can kind of pass on this sort of knowledge or message or sort of peace to Pike, so that she can die instead of Pike.
And that was mentioned in a previous comment. I don't think she knows at all what happens to Pike. I think she's speaking like more generally or something she may have sensed from him because she is, you know, a trained psychologist. So maybe she's just picked up something.
So she's trying to be kind, isn't she, really?
Yeah, yeah.
So Brian Sherman said, so my thoughts about this being one of the greatest seasons in Star Trek history hold. The story was incredible. Kudos to the writers and the outstanding cast for pulling off. So now the one question I have, and I see others do too, is why did Discovery need to go to the future if Leyland Control is dead? I really hope this is addressed in season 3. Captain Pike, number one, and Spock must return in a miniseries or telefilm. Now to the bad. Have we learned nothing from the Star Wars prequels? This is way too much going on during that space battle that it became meaningless. We are human beings and there is nowhere to focus when hundreds of things are happening at once. I'll take the Enterprise and Reliant battle over this mess any day. And how is the Enterprise carrying so many shuttles and drones? Weren't there like two shuttles on the original series? I think seeing two main ships and a few shuttles versus the control ships would have been more than enough.
Yeah, so I think there was a ton going on in the battle, but I didn't find it too confusing. I found for the most part I could follow it, but I could see that there was a lot going on. As far as the shuttles, I think in the last episode, number one, it said that she'd done everything to like commandeer a whole bunch of shuttles and upgrade their weapons, you know, and so, but yeah, they were really cramming the shuttle bay or putting them somewhere else. I don't know. There was a ton of them, but I liked seeing so many actually. What do you think?
I liked seeing all the little different ships when they were protecting Burnham and they were sort of cutting a path for her. I thought that was really cool. That was visually really cool. In a sense, I think I would have appreciated this episode even more if the other episodes precluding it this season hadn't been so action heavy. So there's been a lot of action in season 2, a lot of like explosions and people jumping and running and kind of like a lot of, like swooping camera shots and people sort of barking at each other and all that sort of stuff. So I think this would have been even more dramatic if I hadn't had all of that before, but this is the kind of type of Star Trek that exists now. I think it's very adrenaline focused, very fast paced. It is, I guess, Star Trek for the 21st century in a 21st century audience. So I think there's probably going to be a lot of battles even in season 3, although who they're going to fight with, I don't know. But you know, so I think the sort of excitement and the action is sort of turned up a notch compared to maybe other Star Trek, but I think that's maybe the way that it's going to be in the future now. So yeah, it takes some getting used to, I think.
Yeah. Although Alex Kurtzman has said that the Picard series will have a different feel, and I think he described it as like Discovery's a bullet, and like the Picard series is, you know, a little slower, more contemplative than that. So they may have that kind of tone on other shows.
It'd be hard to see Patrick Stewart like do this week in, week out, wouldn't it, really? I mean, with the way that he delivers dialogue, you know, he delivers dialogue like he's in a Shakespeare play. So it would be nice if it was a little bit slower for him, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's interesting, though, that they've said that the other shows might be different. So, okay. So Duncan Barrett says, hey, that's your co-host from Primitive Culture. So Duncan says, can someone explain how Calypso fits in with this episode? Does Discovery end up in the distant future twice, or did Zora actually evolve much quicker than we thought because of the sphere data? Excellent question, Duncan. So the way that I thought about it is that in Calypso, as long as it's part of the same timeline we've been dealing with, Discovery has sat there for almost 1,000 years. So I think it might actually mean they go to the 32nd century, have some adventures or whatever, for some reason need to leave the Discovery, and then it's sitting there for another 1,000 years until the 42nd century, which is kind of crazy. But that's the way I thought about it.
Yeah, because Calypso, doesn't Zora say in Calypso that she's been alone for 1,000 years? So it's not the Discovery traveling 1,000 years in the future. It's that Discovery travels into the future and then at some point gets left, and then she's alone for 1,000 years, and that's how she develops.
Yeah, because I think it just has to sit there because she's awaiting orders. And I think that this means that Calypso is further into the future than we thought.
I think he's probably right that Zora does develop through using the sphere data.
That's an interesting idea.
I mean, the sphere data is in Discovery, so...
Arium's memories are still in Discovery, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Could be a combination of that. So that'll be interesting to see, but great point.
So Chris Trabuzio says, I am up in space limbo about the finale. Is it because of my mediocre feeling of the week before? Is it because they decided to go Avengers by getting the band back together to defeat the enemy? Seeing as how Endgame premieres this week, I'm not quite sure. These last two episodes have me loving the series for 12 or 14 episodes. As with all things, maybe the opinion shall change during a season rewatch. On a positive spin, I will say the character story was fantastic, the effects fantastic, the score equally so. Yeah, I agree with them. I think that the score was brilliant, I have to say. I noticed the music throughout the entire thing, and it's unusual that I notice music as much as everything else, but they had these little sort of strands of the original series, kind of when the Enterprise showed up, and then some of the Discovery theme when the Discovery was on screen. They kind of mixed the two themes. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it's been really great. And I'm anticipating the soundtrack for season two because I want to just like hear the music as a whole. And actually, like as Burnham was going back to the different points to set the signal, there's that one part, and I definitely want to hear this on the soundtrack, that you saw in... I think in Brother, in episode one of this season, where Burnham, when she's injured on the asteroid, like sees the Red Angel, and there's just this thing that happens in the music that's so like beautiful and haunting. And they brought it back in this episode when they have that moment. Anyway, there are a bunch of things like that this season where I'm like, I really want to listen to the soundtrack. So Jeff Russo continues to do an amazing job. Okay, so Johnny Gleister on Twitter, that's JonnyGlaister, says, Star Trek is amazing, the whole concept of it. It's evolved through every new series of it, and this new series of Discovery is brilliant too. But I can't help but think that none of the episodes of Discovery will match individual episodes of TNG, DS9, or Voyager, which I watch many times. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to try to compare it. I mean, obviously, it's trying to do some different things. I've loved Discovery, and I think some of it is up there with what I've really loved of other series. But like, what do you think? Like, how does it compare to some of the things that you love from other series, other episodes and things and seasons?
Well, when I think of Discovery, I think of Discovery as a season. I don't think of it as individual episodes. So I think of it as a story arc that goes across all seasons. And each episode is a piece of that story. So like a puzzle piece, you know, that goes into a big puzzle, and then you have this big puzzle together. You have the whole image. So I feel like taking an episode of Discovery out of the context of the whole season, I'm not sure I would rewatch a single episode of Discovery. I think I would have to rewatch the entire season over a period of time. So it's not like I would pick, like, I don't know, the lamb or the knife cares not for the butcher's knife cares not for the lamb's cry or whatever it was. I can't imagine myself picking that one out of that season and being like, I'm going to watch that one today, rather than saying I'd watch them in sequence, you know. Whereas with Deep Space Nine and with Next Generation, I would say I'm going to watch Duet, or I'm going to watch what's the one about Sisko kind of and then sort of sang up the Romulans to enter the war, In the Pale Moonlight. I would definitely watch that on its own, because it's not only is it a self-contained story within an episode, which Discovery doesn't do. They don't really do self-contained stories within an episode, but it's also got a theme. It's got like a didactic message. It's got, yeah, I would say a moralistic or didactic message within the story. And I think Discovery might be missing that. I mean, there's certain episodes, but most of it, I sometimes struggle to get the didactic message. And I think that's very much what Star Trek's about. But they may be doing that more in season 3, because if they're moving away from a story arc and they're moving towards exploration and individual sort of storylines within an episode, then, you know, then we might have people rewatching it a bit more like they rewatch TNG or DS9.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that. I think for the most part, I'm going to rewatch seasons as a whole, but there are certain things you could do. Like if you wanted to do like the episodes that relate to original series stuff for Pike, you could have like The Cage, and then If Memory Serves, and then Through the Valley of Shadows, and then like The Menagerie is like a through line for that. There are certain ways that you could do it, and I think there are certain episodes like New Eden that are a little more standalone, but for the most part I would watch it together. But also I think that one of the things they're doing is not so much like in this particular episode, it's this, you know, morality tale or this message, but I think they're weaving certain messages throughout multiple episodes and seasons. Like I've seen like a theme of identity kind of weaving its way through a lot of characters, through a lot of the episodes. And I've also kind of seen people discovering things about themselves and how they relate to the universe and all of that. So I think that it's different, because you can't just isolate it like this is the episode where, you know, there was, you know, this lesson or this message. So
they have done standalone stories before though in short treks. And I would say I probably would rewatch a short trek like I might rewatch DS9. Yeah. So they can do it. I think it's just that when you've got a story to tell and you've only got a certain amount of time, you know, and I honestly believe they're working with more money and more sort of computer effects and more sort of resources. But the one resource they're short on is time, because like Netflix isn't commissioning, or it's CBS, isn't it? Isn't commissioning like 23 hours of Star Trek.
But you know what? I'm actually okay with that, because previously in nearly every season, there would be a couple of episodes where it's like, yeah, I want to skip that one, or that one doesn't work for me. And I don't get that sense at all from Discovery. But
yeah, there's episodes of filler kind of episodes, aren't there? And then they used to have those episodes at the end of a season where they would just like rehash the season, you know, like the one where Riker's in a coma.
Well, thankfully that was the only time that was done. But yeah.
And that was because of a writer's strike or something, wasn't it? So
yeah, it was. Mm-hmm.
So Carolyn Crapo at Carolyn NYC on Twitter says, I loved it, but I'm a little worried about season 3. The ship now has no mission, no supply chain, no friendly star bases or planets to stop at, and their databases, except the spheres, are useless. What will they do past the edge of Federation space in another quadrant even?
Yeah, and I think someone had replied to that like, well, what they always do, seek out new life and new civilizations, boldly go where no one has gone before. Like, I mean, there is actually the possibility for them to do a lot of exploration and, you know, possibly more episodic stuff, right?
I mean, that's Voyager as well, isn't it? I mean, which is great. Like, that I liked that concept of a ship being far away and having to sort of rely on each other and grow stuff in a shuttle bay.
I think it's like Voyager, except they can never go home.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, that's, I think, the difference. So, but yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see. So Joshua DeVries says, I only have one question. At the beginning of the season, Pike knows the location of all 7 signals. When Michael sees Spock's drawing, it matches the galactic map of all 7 signals that they have on file. But then it makes it seem like the signals appear one by one, and they don't know where the next one will be. So, did Michael make the signals appear twice? The Disco crew knows there should be 7 signals because they've already seen the map of where they appear. The appearance of all seven signals is why Pike was assigned to Discovery in the first place. So what caused that first flash of seven signals? Well, my explanation is when Burnham is setting each of the signals, they actually have an echo or reflection back in time into that one moment. So that's how I see it. I don't know if that works. But
yeah, so I mean, I was completely lost with most of this, to be honest. I just was like, oh, whatever they decide to tell me is fine. I mean, it's a little bit like a spore drive. I was like, I'm not going to question it too much. But I understand that maybe, you know, people who have more of a sort of science background or are more interested in the sort of plot details like that. For me, Star Trek is very much about character and characters. Like, you know, when someone's like, you know, the dilithium chamber, I sometimes my brain switches off and I'm like, I just hear technobabble. And I'm like, I don't care what they do in the dilithium chamber. I care if Admiral Cornwall's going to pull the door down and survive. But no, do you know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. So, I mean, I was more interested in the fact that Spock was open to the Red Angel because he was dyslexic. I was like, yay.
Oh, yeah. That was very cool. Yeah.
But I understand that Joshua might be like, what's going on?
I like to try to explain things, but yeah, I can see that.
The last comment is from Casperlita Thompson, and she said, amazing production values. I was particularly impressed by the time travel effects when Burnham was jumping on her own. Love some of the character moments, particularly Stamets and Culber. The cast were amazing as usual. I have mixed feelings about them going into the future and trapping everything non-canon into the must not talk about this box. And why does the spore drive fall into that category? They had the perfect out for the spore drive with its damaging spore network, but they chose to use it again and again after that point. Anyway, I hope that whatever happens 950 years in the future is worth watching. I imagine it probably will be.
Yeah, so about the spore drive, I mean, that's an interesting thing. I had this thought that, like, they want to make sure that there are no more, like, spore drive ships out there because there might be some way that they could, you know, get to Discovery and get a hold of the sphere data in some way because you can time travel with the mycelial network. So that was my thought about it. But I think they're keeping the spore drive because when they're 950 years in the future, it may still be a fun thing to play with and go to, like, far-flung places.
Yeah, I think the spore drive is another sort of plot device, isn't it, really? I mean, in this episode, it felt very much like a plot device. Like, they had to get to this particular area at this particular time. And rather than, like, rushing there by warp, which might have taken too long, they had to, and they had to arrive before the Enterprise, didn't they? So they had to use a spore drive, I guess. It's a way of arriving somewhere quicker.
Oh, from last episode, yeah.
But I think, I agree with her when she says that the spore drive damaging the spore network is a good theme. I think that it's interesting. It's an interesting concept that this idea of clean energy actually turns out not to be as clean as they thought it was. This technological advancement actually turns out to not be as advanced and as undamaging as they thought it was. Because there's a bit where Stamets is arguing with, what's her name again?
You're talking about Reno?
Reno, that's it. Yeah. Stamets is arguing with Reno and they're arguing about, like, clean ways of traveling and less clean ways of traveling. And that's like an environmental debate there, isn't it? And so it's interesting that the spore drive might not be as quite as convenient as they think it is. So I kind of like that idea, but I can see why the writers had to sort of abandon that because they need them to travel somehow, right? So
yeah, I could see that. Well, this has been a bit longer postcards episode than usual, but we wanted to get as much of your feedback as we could in about, you know, what is the single longest episode that's not a two-hour event in all of Star Trek. So I guess it's appropriate. So let's go to some final thoughts. So Clara, how do you think the fans responded to this week's episode?
So I think judging from what, you know, we've just read, I think most of the fans were very positive about this. I think that one of the things that's great about the Trek FM network is that, you know, we have a huge number of listeners and fans who are involved in discussing Star Trek, sort of, I would say, you know, in a friendly and, you know, open environment on the Babel conference. And though there's things that they don't like, they're also willing, they're very open-minded, I think, about new ideas in Star Trek and new ways of writing Star Trek and sharing Star Trek and experiencing Star Trek. So I think that it was definitely a very exciting episode. And it was a really good finale episode. I think in terms of finales, it gave us everything we wanted. It gave us emotion. It gave us snappy one-liners. It gave us a lot of action. It gave us sort of a noble sacrifice, you know, with Admiral Cornwall and also Burnham and the whole crew of Discovery. And it also gave us this big unknown question mark of where Discovery is going to go in the future. And Star Trek's filled with these unknown question marks. I mean, that's all about going out where no man's gone before. So, well, no one, sorry, I should say no one has gone before. So I think the fans really recognize that. And I think they see that this is going to be a new exciting era for Star Trek.
I really couldn't have said it better. I think you said everything perfectly appropriate, like about the finale. And as Amy Nelson likes to say, we have the best listeners. I mean, really, like, there was almost 600 comments to go through. And sure, there can be some, you know, spirited discussion going on in there, but I think it is really respectful and people are really like open to hearing out different opinions. So listeners, people in the Babel conference and those that responded on Twitter, thank you. I mean, you really make this possible. This show, Postcards, is only possible because of your feedback. That's all that it's based on. So thank you for all that you've done, you know, in these different seasons. And as I said, Amy will be back next week with the season 2 recap episode. So be sure to check out our Discovery coverage throughout the week. Live from the Edge with Bruce and Brandy airs on Fridays at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube, and will be released as a podcast on Saturday mornings. Now, of course, that's already been released from the season finale one, but we'll see. Maybe they'll do some Short Trek stuff. Our commentary will be available as Tracks from the Edge with Mike and Max. And of course, you can catch full analysis on the Edge main show with Patrick and Amy. To wrap up the coverage, join us for Notes from the Edge for links between Discovery and the broader franchise with Chris Jones. So as listeners might know, Chris has been extremely busy with what he's doing for work, but he does intend on putting out some Notes from the Edge episodes now that season 2 has concluded. So just wanted to let everyone know that. So you'll find all of these podcasts in the main feed for The Edge and in the Trek.fm master feed. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Discovery, and the best place to do that is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, where Amy will collect your feedback for Postcards from The Edge. You can also find us on Twitter at Trek.fm or send us email using the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select The Edge. So Clara, where can people find you online?
So you can find me on the Trek FM network show Primitive Culture, which is released every fortnight. And you can also find me on Twitter at ClaraJeanMC. So please feel free to head over to Twitter and tweet me or say hello and tell me what you think about Star Trek Discovery.
Excellent. Well, and you can find me elsewhere on the network co-hosting Earl Grey with my friends Amy Nelson and Richard Marquez. We have a great time talking about The Next Generation every week. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet out nothing but Star Trek, lots of Discovery stuff, and lots of other Star Trek stuff. And you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows going and even become an associate producer, visit patreon.com/trekfm for all the details. We would like to thank our current associate producers, Norman Lau, Tony Robinson, Thomas Puleo, Lisa Slack, Shoab Mirza, Richard Rutledge, James Muldrow, Cornelia Reutner, Ryan Mallett, Chris Tribusio, and Brian Malosh. Thank you for supporting Trek FM and especially The Edge. So thank you, Clara, for coming on Postcards. It was so much fun talking about the Discovery Season 2 finale with you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really, really enjoyed my time here.
Excellent. So join us next week for another episode of Postcards from The Edge. Hailing frequencies open.